And of course, when I confronted him with that, he denied it. But that started to make me feel uncomfortable, that he would refer to the library as his own, and if they didn't like it, they could leave, and that this operation was his, and he could do with it as he pleased, essentially. As I said, I didn't want to believe the extent or that he was even participating in lying, but I heard from Tom and from Will that John was complaining that our family had given no money to the center and showed no support. And at that time, I believe I had given $3,000 so far to the center. This was, you know, this was in the, by the fall of 89, 1 year after. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I have the check receipts to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was saying that we who were showing no support felt horrible. And it was as if, well, I felt like he was trying to stir up some trouble between myself and Tom Davis. And I felt that on several occasions, John played people against each other.
All righty. Now, I would also reiterate that I myself was not involved in any direct fashion with the center, so I'm not in a position to independently verify the allegations that are made by the various volunteers. But it is your contention, Cayenne, that John was deliberately deceiving people with regard to a number of different things.
Yes, and I didn't believe that at first, and I didn't want to believe it, but that is my opinion now.
All right, and we will hear from some of the other volunteers later. Now, I was told by many of the volunteers who quit that they simply found John impossible to work with. Or is it your understanding that the various conflicts and machinations that you have spoken about were the reasons why most of the volunteers quit in the fall of 1989?
Yes. They cared a lot about the center, and they pleaded to find some way to carry on without John Judge, and all of them expressed their willingness to continue to work and do what they could, but that it was impossible for them to work with John.
Now, my recollection, Cayenne, and this, we're now in the fall of 1989. Do you recall which month it was that most of the volunteers quit?
I think it was November.
November.
I remember it, yes.
Okay. My recollection, and I'm going to see if perhaps I can get Tom Davis's input on this, but my recollection was that the locks were changed on the center at around this time. Is that your recollection?
Yeah, well, I think the volunteers quit,
mm-hmm.
and at that point, Tom and Will were also scared and had some doubts about John, and they removed the core parts of May's files. They took them out. They didn't feel that they were safe there. And at that point, I believe that's when John changed the locks.
That's my recollection, too. But again, we're operating in the distance of several years. And while some of these events and the exact dates are etched in stone in my memory, there are some things that I am not totally clear on myself. And there are many aspects of the center about which I knew nothing except third-hand accounts. So now, the same account was given to me by Tom Davis of Tom Davis Books and Will Robinson of KAZU-FM about removing the core of May's library from the center at this time. I know they told me they didn't trust John, but they never, to my recollection, were explicit about why. Did they ever explain to you, Cayenne, or to anyone you know about why they removed the files?
Well, John was acting suspiciously in these different ways that I've expressed, and the volunteers, I know, were complaining to them as well. And I imagine that their own suspicions were aroused.
Well, that it is interesting. And now, it is your understanding, and it is also my recollection, that it was after Tom Davis and Will Robinson removed the core of May's files because they didn't trust John, that John changed the locks on the center, because earlier you said it was after Tom and Will attempted to unpack May's books.
Right. No, I think that's when he took the keys back.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. What else happened with the center? And by the way, we are now in the fall of 1989, according to Cayenne's recollection, November of 1989, some 14 months after May died, or actually 13 months after May died. 14 months after the center got going, because it was actually initiated while May was on her deathbed.
Well, John never incorporated the center as an independent identity. He began the process, but he never followed it through with any energy or fervor. The umbrella organization, the fiscal sponsor that was protecting the center and making it safe for nonprofit tax-deductible donations, requested that John give them a book of the records of all the money earned for their own tax purposes, which John never did. He promised that he would, and they needed these records. And John just, he never followed through on that. And no financial records were kept until the very end and closing of the center. He wrote checks, but the monies that came in weren't recorded against what was being spent. Some things were recorded, some were not, and it was just a lot of financial sloppiness around which the volunteers, I believe, were also kept from that area. They, you know, the volunteers were allowed to do very specific jobs that John designated, and beyond which he kept a lot of areas split off or secret or separate. And the financial dealings were one of them. We had a very small board, and John wanted it that way. There was only himself, myself, and one other fellow named Dave. And every time I spoke of increasing the board, John and Dave would shy away from the idea. John would shy away, and Dave would back up John. And I felt like I'd had very limited control or power or influence over the decisions made because there was three of us, and Dave would vote consistently with John. And so any suggestion I made would get swept aside or pushed under, and I felt I needed more support.
In other words, what you're saying, Kyan, is that basically the board was composed of three people, and it was two against one as far as you were concerned.
Yes,
now,
that's right.
Let me go back over some of the things that you said and see if I'm understanding you correctly. You're maintaining that the nonprofit organization, which as I recall was an anti-nuke group, is that correct? That this organization was never provided with a full financial accounting of the monies that had been donated to the May Russell Center. It should be noted that people giving money to the May Russell Center were donating through this nonprofit organization. Now, it is your contention, your recollection, that no financial accounting was ever provided to this organization?
That's right.
And had there been an agreement to do so?
Yes.
Now, one of the things that I remember very specifically about the May Russell Center is that it was advertised in its literature and solicitations were done specifically referring to the May Russell Center as a nonprofit organization, and the donations were represented as being tax deductible.
That can be done as long as there is a fiscal sponsor, which there was.
It can be done as long as there's a fiscal sponsor until incorporation takes place.
Right.
One of the things that I would note for the record is that any nonprofit corporation, any nonprofit organization in the state of California has to be registered with the Office of the Secretary of State in Sacramento. A form has to be filed. I'm not sure if it's a 2310 form or not, and a board of directors set up. And this has to be approved by the Office of the Secretary of State of California. Was the May Russell Research Center ever incorporated?
No, not as its own independent identity.
And it should be noted, too, that the center was actually begun in September of 1988, and it went belly up in December of 89 or January of 90. That's a period of some 16 months. But you're saying that it was never incorporated.
No.
And it is your contention, your recollection, that John Judge was not keeping accurate financial records?
Right, that's my opinion.
Now, are there other people who share that opinion?
Yes, and at the end he hired an accountant to quickly put the books together and piece them together from all the records that had been kept scantily. And to fictitiously recreate an accounting as if the books had been kept all along, where it was clear to everyone that they had not been and that this woman was hired to save face at the last minute.
So what you're saying, basically, is that you're of the opinion that John cooked the books.
Yeah, and I know that approximately $50,000 that was raised was recorded. There may have been more money raised by the center that we'll never know about.
All righty. That is something to bear in mind. And by the way, I'm going to discuss some of the financial improprieties later. I did consult an attorney about the lack of incorporation of the May Brussels Center. And even though monies can be donated through an umbrella organization, eventually the organization has to be incorporated. No papers were ever filed with the Office of the Secretary of State of California. In the opinion of counsel, and I want to emphasize I am not an attorney and so I am not an expert on legal matters, but in the opinion of counsel, this made the entire May Brussels Center an act of fraud. I would also stress that, or relate, that this same attorney was of the considered legal opinion that because the mails were used to solicit monies for the center and it was specifically represented in the literature as a nonprofit tax-deductible organization, that constituted mail fraud in his considered legal opinion. And I want to reemphasize that I am not an attorney myself. I'm not an expert on legal matters, so that I am relating his legal opinion, not my own. Now, this brings us, what, to about November or December of 1989,
Cayenne? Yes.
What transpired next?
Well, John was hanging out with this gal named Wendy from Washington, D.C., and she came in as an overnight researcher who had supposedly been doing this work a long time and cared and wanted to help the center get off the ground, but none of us had ever heard of her, and May had certainly never heard of her. And John was apparently in love with her and would stay up all night talking on the phone. The volunteers would hear him in the other room talking baby talk on the phone with Wendy. And John wanted to have her come and be part of the board. And this was around the same time that I was wanting to expand the board to include May's friends, and John was refusing or dissuading me from doing that, from including other people that May had trusted and liked and explicitly expressed that she wanted on the board. And John was trying to make that not happen. So at that point, I brought in an attorney who was friends of our family to get the incorporation process happening and to extend the board.
Now, bear in mind that, as we heard in Cayenne's previous account, the board consisted of three people: John Judge, his right-hand man Dave, and Cayenne. And by Cayenne's accounts, John and Dave consistently opposed her desires. By the way, remember the individual Dave, because I'm going to discuss his background later on in the broadcast, because it's a factor that entered in. Go ahead, Cayenne. So you brought in an attorney to expand the board and begin the requisite legal incorporation process.
That's right.
This some 15 or 16 months after the center had actually begun and monies were beginning to be solicited.
Yes. And around that time, my husband, Avishai, got a scary, threatening phone call. It was anti-Semitic and called him a dirty Jew and that he was going to be killed. And I don't know that this has anything to do with it, but it was at a time when this woman, Wendy, was around who I didn't feel secure with, and I was opposing her position coming into the center in a central way. And obviously I got this phone call, and the next morning the mirror on my car had been vandalized. I mean, this may have been a coincidence, but it was suspicious and it was frightening.
I will discuss that particular incident, and I will also reiterate that this may have been pure coincidence. Coincidences do happen. But the anti-Semitic death threat against Cayenne's husband, her car being vandalized or found vandalized the following morning. This during a period when, by Cayenne's account and that of those of other people, Cayenne had entered into a state of open opposition, or John, I should say, had entered into a state of open opposition with Cayenne. This also was a factor in my decision to speak out against the May Brussels Center. I had spoken out about it after the volunteers, or most of the volunteers, had quit, and also after Tom Davis and Will Robinson had removed the core of May's files. But I really opened up at about this particular period of time. And once again, there may have been no connection between the threat against Cayenne's husband, the anti-Semitic death threat, and the vandalization of her car at the same time. But this also was a factor in my decision to speak out against the center. I would note, as I will go into at greater length later, John Judge had a long-standing, though as yet indeterminate, relationship with elements of a far right-wing tax protest organization, some of whose members at any rate appear to be Aryan Nations or of Aryan Nations orientation. They are, some of them, and again, I'm not accusing John of this, but he did have a relationship of indeterminate nature over a period of years with elements of this group, at least one person or one or two people, and that they were into, at least some of them, into identity Christianity, which is the anti-Semitic theology of the Aryan Nations. And that was something that I had deep misgivings about. Those misgivings deepened enormously when Cayenne's husband received the anti-Semitic death threat and her car was vandalized. Cayenne, have you received any threats since that time?
In the fall of 1990, I got another scary phone call. It was nothing specific, but it was very scary. It had some creepy music, and it said, "I deeply weep for you, I deeply sympathize," with a very lurchy, deep, scary voice, and played some creepy music, and that was it. There was a second call in the spring, the following spring.
Okay, so now the other threatening call or creepy phone call was in the fall or the spring of 90?
The spring of 90.
Spring of 90, okay.
Yeah.
Now, what was it specifically that bothered you and others about this woman, Wendy? And I would interject at this point that I never met the woman and am unfamiliar except by third-hand accounts of what this was all about, so I'm not in a position to evaluate this past a point myself.
Well, the woman came in from Washington, D.C. as an overnight researcher and was supposedly in love with John Judge. And their love affair consisted of long telephone talks and of tape cassettes that she would send him. And I heard one of these cassettes that the volunteers had gotten hold of, and it sounded like my understanding of what I've heard of mind control.
Mm-hmm.
With codes and hypnotic trances and referring back to things that she had said before and speaking in this sort of double talk language,
mm-hmm.
using code words. And it was, that alone was very scary, along with John's behavior, which I'll later get into, that seemed, indicative of somebody on mind control or my understanding of that process. And that John wanted her to come in and be part of the board, and somebody she was new in his life, and yet he was so suspicious of people that May had known for 15 years, yet he was willing to let this woman in overnight, nearly. There was also talk that she had been at some gathering or party in Washington with William Bennett, the drug czar, and hobnobbed in some of these inner circles in Washington, D.C.
Now, I myself was sent a copy of one of these cassettes, and it did sound very strange. In fact, the aforementioned Will Robinson of KAZU obtained one of these cassettes, and that cassette is now, by the way, on file with counsel. It did sound strange to me. I never met the woman, Wendy, but she was talking in a very strange sort of hypnotic sounding way. I remember one conversation where she said, We're going out beyond the stars, beyond the sun, past Venus, past Pluto. And I don't know whether it was a mind control tape or whether this was John and Wendy's concept of aesthetics, but it certainly sounded very, very strange.
Yes. And when the topic was brought up of Wendy being part of the board, and I expressed my misgivings around this,
mm-hmm.
she sat with a cold face the entire time, and at the end squeezed out a few tears and proceeded to attempt to make me feel guilty, I imagine, saying, I don't know why you suspect me, and I just want to help out, and I'm just a good person who wants to do what I can. And I said to her, look, if you know anything about this work, surely you can respect my suspicions of you without taking them personally. If you have any sense of what this work is about and how valuable this collection is and how justified I would be in my feelings, yet, you know, she persisted in this, as I saw them, crocodile tears.
Mm-hmm. Well, that obviously I'm not in a position to evaluate. I was not at the meeting. I would note at this point that as of December of 1989, John had entered into open defiance of the desires of the Brussel family in the person, obviously, of Cayenne Brussel, who was handling the Brussel estate on behalf of the family. Cayenne, you mentioned that you were frightened, obviously, when Abishai got the death threat. Were you yourself frightened at this point of the situation with Wendy?
Yes, I was frightened for not only our safety, but for the collection and for John, wondering who he was and how much he was working with her, how much he was under her control.
Mm-hmm.
And but the whole situation felt very unsafe for me, and I didn't feel good about the collection, especially with John referring to it as his own. Made me feel very uncomfortable. And at that time, my brother wrote a letter on behalf of our family to John, asking him for his resignation, you know, to step out. And at the same time, John wrote a resignation letter that crossed in the mail. I believe they crossed in the mail at that time.
Now, your brother is an attorney, correct?
Right.
Right. Okay, so your attorney brother wrote a letter informing John, basically, that he was no longer welcome, and his letter of resignation crossed in the mails.
Yes.
Now, what happened after that, Cayenne?
Well, John hired an accountant before the last meeting, as I said, to fictitiously present the books, and approximately $50,000 was said to be raised, but we don't know how much more was actually raised beyond that. I know that there were big checks written that John wrote to himself, saying that they were reimbursement for money that he had put in. There were several checks around $5,000 that he had written to himself, reimbursing for who knows what. These things were never itemized. And when Tom and Will went to close out the bank account, Tom's name, which had been a co-signer on the account, had been removed, and he was denied to look at the records or the transactions that had happened. And he was furious and baffled and said to the bank, how can you do this? I'm a co-signer and I've written checks on this account. And somehow they protected John, who had changed the books secretly without informing Tom, and it had Tom's name removed so that he couldn't look at the financial records. And later that day, they ran into each other at a Xerox shop, and John completely ignored Tom in a small Xerox shop in Santa Cruz. Tom was aghast because John was not only an old friend and had tried to avoid direct conflict with John, had gone out of his way to step out and not confront him, was now being totally ignored by John in the confines of 3 feet. John looked right past him like a zombie, and this was the other point that made me suspicious about mind control. He was in a total state of denial, or he was under some kind of hypnosis, because, and Tom could express this better than I could because it was his own experience, but I remember him totally dumbfounded by that.
So what you're saying is that Tom Davis, who had been the co-signer for the May Brussel Research Center account and had written checks against the account, went to close it on behalf of you and the Brussel family. And at that point, John had altered or had changed the bank records so that only his name, John Judge's, that is, was on the signature card, and the bank would not allow Tom Davis access to the records of the account.
That's right.
And then later you're saying that John walked right by Tom Davis without even acknowledging his physical presence.
Right.
One of the things in connection with the possible mind control connection, the one thing I noticed, Kyan, and I didn't have much contact with John, the last time I saw John was in October of 1989 at a memorial service at May's grave on the roughly first anniversary of her death or funeral. Can't remember which it was. But I noticed that there was a very different look in his eyes, and that was also the observation of several other people. The expression in John's eyes had changed dramatically from what I had seen in my previous dealings with them. Do you recall that yourself, or is that not your impression?
I don't recall that, but I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know how closely I was looking at his eyes at that point.
Okay, because I'm just saying that was one thing I noticed, and it raised some questions in my mind, but obviously the whole question of John possibly being under mind control is indeterminate, and I seriously doubt will ever be fully resolved. After Tom Davis and Will Robinson, and by the way, I would once again emphasize that the same account has been provided to me independently by Tom Davis and Will Robinson of KAZU. After Tom attempted to close the account on behalf of the Brussel family, was denied access to the records because John had his name and not Tom's on the signature card. What transpired after that, Kyan?
Well, I need to also say that bank account remained active for months after the center was officially closed and after the time that John had agreed upon to close out the account. I had heard when we were on the day that we were cleaning the house and closing out that there was approximately $2,000 plus in the bank account left. And that was after John had paid himself back and reimbursed this and that. Several months later, I got the statement from the bank with the balance that had been left, which was $569.
Out of some $50,000 allegedly collected.
Right, after also being told that there was going to be over $2,000, which was surprisingly low in itself, to get the check back for $569. Also, the account had been active, clearly, because, you know, nearly $1,500 had been removed or used or spent in some other way beyond the time that John had promised to have the account closed. There was a series of promises and agreements that John failed to follow through on.
What were some of those, Kyan?
Well, this is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And just meetings and times, just a series of things. It's hard to, I mean, all of the things I've been speaking about.
All righty. So this, at this point, you're saying that the May Brussel Research Center account remained active for a considerable period of time after John agreed to close it.
Yes, and one of those other agreements that John made that he failed to follow through on was giving me a list of labels with the donors.
Mm-hmm.
He promised to have a mailing list so that I could send out a mailing to the nearly 5,000 members of the center and let them know, in my own words, what had happened. Well, he didn't provide me the list of labels, as he promised, and he gave me a computer disk with no instructions as to how to access. He made it sound rather simple to use and as if I'd have no problems, which later I found it more complex for myself. But he didn't follow through on the labels and didn't make it easy for me to do a mailing of any sort to the donors.
Okay.
And that was another one of the agreements that John failed to follow through on. Another one comes to mind now, which is on the closing of the center, I came in with Karen and several of the volunteers to clean the house to get the cleaning deposit back. Cleaning deposit was, I think, $1,480. It was over $1,400.
Mm-hmm.
And John clearly expressed that if we cleaned the house, of course we could have the cleaning deposit. Well, we came in as a team, and worked all day. The house was filthy. It hadn't been cleaned in the whole time that it had existed. There was dust and dirt and filth everywhere. And we scrubbed the house from top to bottom. And John left for the day. He said, "Oh, hello," and he went out, and he didn't lift a finger. And when I spoke to the landlord later, he told me that John had told him that the cleaning deposit was to be sent back to John, contrary to what John had told me. And this is the kind of things that shrouded John Judge's, my experience with John Judge, just surrounded every dealing, especially as it went on, filled with inconsistencies and mistrust and failing to follow through and double stories to different people. And the landlord had been told by John that John would forward the cleaning deposit to me, which he never did. And I've written him letters asking about it, which he either didn't answer or didn't pick up. I sent a certified letter, which months later was returned to me unclaimed.
Now, John never signed for the certified letter?
No.
Do you know if he had moved, or was he still living at the same address?
I checked that out with several people who would know, and that was the last address they had for him.
Okay.
Yeah. And then furthermore, the mail had been being forwarded to me from the research center. And just this last spring, when I was failing to get any more mail, I called the post office. And they said that the forward had expired. And rather than letting me know that the expiration date was coming up, they just flipped the mail back to go back to John Judge at that point.
Okay.
And I told them they couldn't do that, you know, the mailbox was taken out under the Mae Brussels Research Center, to whom I was now responsible, and that our board had decided that this is where the mail would come, et cetera, et cetera. And the postmaster rigorously defended John and said that because he had been the one that had rented the box, that's where the mail was going now that it had expired. And I said, "Well, what if I send in the check to pay for the reissuing of it?" And he said, "No, it's too late." And I mean, there wasn't much mail coming at that point, but it was disturbing to find that the mail was again going back to John, and that his connection to the center and to the donor list and to the people that want to support my mother's work was being intercepted by him.
In other words, John had somehow managed to, in contradiction of your agreement or contravention of your agreement, he had somehow managed to arrange for the mail to be forwarded to him rather than you.
Either I can't say for sure that he had arranged that, but it seemed to be that the postmaster was in cahoots with him. I can't say definitely, but it looked that way.
Okay.
Given the other circumstances, I wouldn't be surprised.
All righty. Well, obviously that is an open question, but it is certainly a very interesting and possibly sinister one. Is there anything else that you wanted to relate about what happened with the center, Cayenne? Any other interesting or alarming details?
Well, there was this prevailing winds that came out in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you advised me not to give them permission to sell May's research.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the fellow there, Patrick Formey, to what extent he was involved with John Judge, because this organization opened up soon after the center had closed
in
Santa Barbara. And he made it sound like they didn't have much of a connection at all, and that he just wanted to sell all the researchers' published works or printed materials to get out as much information as he could. And I felt a little cautious and suspicious about him, but he, he urged me to let him sell my mother's work, that he just wanted to get out her valuable information, et cetera. And it seems that he is more connected with John than he would have me believe.
I would add that this organization is once again called Prevailing Winds Research from Santa Barbara, California, about which I have no hard information. In the spring of 1990, Cayenne called me asking me if I had ever heard of that organization or this fellow Patrick Formey. And the answer was no on both accounts. When you're in this line of work, sometimes you learn to go on instinct. So I basically sniffed the air. I advised Cayenne against giving permission for them to reprint May's material because it just felt, and this is not, was nothing more than instinct, that this might very well represent John Judge attempting to get back in the door somehow. I would add that in the fall of 1990, John Judge appeared on radio station KFI in Los Angeles as a guest. I was able to get that broadcast very faintly. And at the end, John referred people to Prevailing Winds Research for access to his material. I would also say that I have been told, and this is hearsay, so as such should be taken perhaps with a grain of salt, that Patrick Forme recently arranged for a major speaking engagement for John Judge in Toronto. I know he had such an engagement, and I will prove that later in the broadcast. I have been told, and there may be nothing to it, but I have been told that the aforementioned Patrick Forme did help arrange that speaking engagement, but that is hearsay evidence and should be taken as such.
Yeah, the only other thing I want to say is that at the beginning of this whole procedure, I didn't want to believe that about John. And it was easier...
Didn't want to believe which, Cayenne?
I didn't want to believe that there was any misgivings around him or that he was suspicious or that there was any deeper reason for alarm beyond him being a difficult personality to get along with or, you know, a quirky individual. I would rather have attributed the trouble and the conflict to elements of his personality. And at the time that a lot of the conflict started to happen, it was hard for me to see that. It was hard for me to recognize that John was not worthy of my trust and that there was integrity issues to be questioned here surrounding John Judge. And that... And that I just really appreciate the support that I felt I've had from you.
Okay. Two quick questions, kind of three very quick questions, because we're going to have to move along. We're almost out of time and tape. It says here in Vankin's book, the center collapsed to be resurrected by Davis and some associates as the May Russell Library in Seaside, California. Is the library resurrected in Seaside?
No, that's not true at all. I know that Will took out a P.O. box in Seaside. That's not even where the account is based, which is based in Berkeley through a P.O. box there.
Okay.
That is just where Will gets his mail anonymously, and that is not where the center is not set up, or the library is not set up in any sense at this point. We hope to work with it later, but it's in no state at this point to be resurrected.
Okay, Cayenne, two quick questions as we're going to have to move. Do you remember something called the Picnic on the Grassy Knoll?
Yes.
Okay, well, I will talk about that later. This was supposed to be a gathering of researchers on the Grassy Knoll in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1989. PICNIC was an acronym standing for Public Information Creates New Intelligence Circles. I will come back to that later. Okay, Cayenne, I wanted to get your opinion on one more piece of information here. Again, reading from Jonathan Vankin's book, his relating of Tom Davis's opinion. One of the problems was Dave Emery. Davis says he personally implored Emery, to whom the May Russell Research Center will always be so called, not to attack the center on his show. In the fall of 1989, Emery burst. Restraining himself for a year, he could no longer hold it in and went on the air accusing Judge of financial improprieties and other sordid acts. In private, Emery is even more vitriolic. What, Cayenne, being the person most in the vantage point to assess what happened with the center, what is your opinion of Tom Davis's assessment, basically laying much of the blame on the center's demise on yours truly?
Well, I think it's grotesque because Tom, as well as anyone close to the center, would know how much John was at the heart of all of the problems that went on there. And he himself was was involved with disappointments and shocking revelations about John Judge. So to the extent that this is an accurate quote of Tom Davis, I'm appalled.
I would add that I will be once again giving my own account of what transpired, including my dealings with Tom Davis later on in the broadcast. Kayan, the last question I want to ask you is, what was your impression of my role and activities vis-a-vis you and the center?
Well, I know that you had a lot of concern and fear around the center and frustration as well, that people were not seeing what you were saying about John early on. And I felt a lot of support from you throughout that process. I know that when I felt afraid and I felt that you were really there and doing what you could to protect myself as well as the material.
All righty. Well, I was certainly doing my best in that regard. And again, I will be giving my own account of not only the conflicts between John Judge, but also other pieces of information which people might not be aware of, a speaking engagement which had been tentatively arranged between John and I in Los Angeles. John managed to cut me out of that, basically maneuvering me out of $200 and some other things not directly relevant to what happened with the people at the center proper. Well, Kayan, it's been unpleasant for you, I'm sure, and I know it's been unpleasant for me to have to go back and relive this very unpleasant and, for me at least, very searing experience. But I want to thank you for your participation and for your bravery and integrity in agreeing to help set the record straight about what actually happened with the center. I think I can say with confidence that May would not have wanted the fictional account of what happened with the May Brussels Center as presented in Vanken's book to pass into the historical record. I also would note in passing, as I will have already discussed on the air by the time this airs, that the book itself was published by Paragon House, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Reverend Moon's Unification Church. While Vanken's own connection with it might be perfectly innocent, he very well not have known, and I fully acknowledge that for the record. The fact of the matter is that this book is going to make monies for Reverend Moon. And beyond that, Vanken has been very visible as of late doing the talk show circuit and specifically dropping May's name in an attempt, basically, in my opinion, to sell books. And I think I can state with absolute confidence that if May were alive, if she read the account that appears in Vanken's book, and if she knew that he was dropping her name to sell books for the Reverend Moon, she would spit in his face.
Serious. She'd be doing much of what you're doing right now.
Well, I'm doing what I can, and I will continue to do that. So, Kayan, once again, I want to thank you for agreeing to appear.
Sure. Thank you, Dave.
And I will be doing everything I can to continue to support you, and when necessary, if necessary, and I hope not, protect you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again.
Me too. Take care.
Okie doke.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And that concludes the interview with Kayan Brussels. Again, the person most centrally involved with the May Brussels Research Center, handling May's material on behalf of the Brussels family and the Brussels estate. I'm going to go back over, and by the way, it should be stated that in the interviews that have been and are going to be aired, some of what is being said is personal opinion, and as such, should be taken with a grain of salt. But I know Kayan very well, and I'm close to her, and she is a woman of integrity. She's also extremely bright. She is her mother's daughter. And the experiences of Kayan, which I'm going to relate, I'm going to recap for you for the most part, and those of the other people at the center are important to take note of. And once again, I want to reiterate that I myself, far from being one of the factors to bring down the May Brussels Center, had so little to do with it that I didn't know much of what you're going to be hearing this evening until I began conducting these interviews. First of all, let's go over the points that Kayan cited. She observed, and I'm going to come back to the fact, that while John was on the East Coast getting his things together to move west, he would not let Tom Davis have a key to the center. It was under lock and key to some complete strangers to May's crowd and to May personally. The question, of course, is why? Tom Davis was one of May's most trusted associates. He also is in the book business, lived close to the center, and had there been an emergency, either a fire or a break-in or something, Tom would have been a logical person to have a key. So the question is, why? Later, I believe this was November of 1988, the aforementioned Will Robinson of KAZU-FM and Tom Davis attempted to unpack May's books at the center, and John Judge, by the accounts given me by both Tom Davis and Will Robinson, flew off the handle, literally threw a temper tantrum. At that point, Tom Davis himself concluded, by the account he gave me, that he would not be on the board of directors, and he had relatively little to do with the center from that point forward. It should be noted, again, that on October 9th, 1988, I offered John Judge, far from competing for radio kudos, we're going to talk about that later, I offered John Judge the position of being my co-host, and not only to avoid a conflict, which I did not want, but also to teach John, frankly, how to do professional research, and we will touch on John Judge as a pure researcher later on in the broadcast. And again, that was a person who at that time I neither liked, trusted, nor respected. It's frankly all I could have done under the circumstances. There was a gathering on November 11th, 1988, which I will talk about later, at which we attempted to smooth over our differences. The people that I wanted there to bear witness to some of what was going on were not allowed to be there, allegedly for reasons of security. We'll talk about that later. It should be noted that most of the volunteers quit, and we are going to be hearing from many of the volunteers during the course of the broadcast this evening, most via tape. One volunteer is live and will be in the studio. By the way, due to the limitations of time, and I'm going to be pressed for time this evening, I did not interview Tom Davis for this broadcast. Tom Davis has had his say, and his remarks will be recorded for posterity in Vankin's book, again published by Paragon House, owned by the Unification Church. Extending the Pearl Harbor metaphor that I began last week, I think it would be proper to let Tom Davis's remarks live in infamy in this particular book. It should be noted that in the fall of 1989, most of the volunteers did quit, and after that happened, Tom Davis and Will Robinson, in accounts provided me independently by both, removed the core of May's files. And what Tom and Will told me was that at this point, John changed the locks on the May Brussels Research Center. Cayenne brought an attorney in to straighten things out and to get the center incorporated. It was specifically advertised as a non-profit, tax-deductible organization, and yet it was never incorporated. The center got underway in September of 1988. By December or January of 1989-90, it still had not been incorporated. No papers had been filed. Now, it should be noted that the process of incorporation for a nonprofit organization can take up to 2 years, and monies can be solicited during the period while the organization is waiting for approval, but no papers were ever filed. And this could have been readily documented had Vankin done the research. Simply contact the Office of the Secretary of State of California in Sacramento some 15 or 16 months after the center got going, and who knows how much money got raised. There was no incorporation, no serious attempt to, at least on the part of John Judge. And as I mentioned, in the opinion, the considered legal opinion of counsel, and I'm not an expert on such matters myself, this made the May Brussels Center an act of fraud. And once again, in the considered legal opinion of counsel, and I am not an expert in this matter, the fact that the mails were used would basically constitute mail fraud under the circumstances. Cayenne also related a series of financial improprieties. According to Cayenne, and this is not something that I can personally confirm, this is in no way to impugn Cayenne's integrity. She is a woman of great integrity, but again, I had so little to do with the center that I was not there and cannot verify this. I have heard this from other people who were at the center, but that no financial records were kept, and that at the last minute, at least according to Cayenne and others at the center, John brought in a bookkeeper to, in their opinion, cook the books. Cayenne also related that the nonprofit organization, an anti-nuke organization, through which the monies were being donated, was never given a proper accounting of the monies donated by John Judge as he had agreed to do. In December of 1989,
John Judge entered into a state of open defiance of Kyan Brussel vis-a-vis a number of matters, particularly expanding the board. I do not know anything about the woman, Wendy, about whom you've heard and about whom you will hear more from some of the other volunteers. As I said, I had so little to do with the center that I wouldn't know this particular woman if she passed me on the street. But I did hear a tape recording of a conversation that John and Wendy had had. You heard my account of it on that tape. It was very strange. Wendy was speaking in a very strange voice, saying, "We're going out now beyond the stars, beyond the sun, beyond Venus, beyond Pluto." And I didn't know really what to make of it. I don't know whether it was a mind control tape or, as I said, whether it was simply John and Wendy's sense of the romantic aesthetics. But it was one of the strangest things I've ever heard in my life. A copy of that tape was sent to counsel by the aforementioned Will Robinson of KAZUFM. I do not know how he obtained it. You would have to ask him about that. I would note, too, that Wendy was a complete stranger to May, and as we'll hear, at least according to some of the volunteers, John and Wendy met over the phone. And that's sort of strange in light of the obsession that John maintained, or that he advertised about security for the center. And it should also be noted again that as John entered into open defiance of Kyan, her husband received an anti-Semitic death threat over the telephone. According to Kyan's account, it was something like, something, Abishai, you dirty Jew, you're going to die. And the next day, she came out to find that her car had been vandalized. That may have been a coincidence, maybe had nothing to do whatsoever with her opposition to John Judge. And I fully acknowledge that for the record. But on the other hand, it was alarming and suspicious, and I'm going to come back to that later in the broadcast. It should be noted, too, that John's right-hand man in the center, a fellow named Dave, consistently opposed Kyan's and consequently the Brussel family's wishes along with John Judge. It was basically two men against one woman, and by Kyan's own account anyway, they consistently sort of ganged up on her. I would note, too, I have only met that fellow Dave a couple of times, but he has some things in his background which are interesting. They may be insignificant, and I fully acknowledge that possibility for the record. But this fellow apparently grew up with a family of Catherine MacDonald. Catherine MacDonald was the widow of the late Larry MacDonald, at one time head of the John Birch Society, an ultra-right-wing activist whose best-known creation was a right-wing private intelligence organization called Western Goals, which has very strong associations with the U.S. national security establishment. After Larry MacDonald was killed in the crash of KAL-007, or the shooting down of KAL-007 in 1983, Catherine MacDonald took over Western Goals for a time, and I believe actually assumed Larry MacDonald's congressional seat for a period of time. Western Goals was best known for a scandal. They were sued by the ACLU in the early 80s when it was discovered that elements of the Los Angeles Police Department were conducting political espionage for Western Goals, literally collecting information on people with whose politics these policemen and the Western Goals disagreed, and the information was being put into computer banks. And according to people familiar with their background, this fellow Dave, I don't know whether it was him or his half-sister, was close to the MacDonald family in his youth. His half-sister was reported to have double-dated with Catherine MacDonald, and apparently Catherine MacDonald, and again, they were very young, was a babysitter for them, too. Again, there may be no significance to that whatsoever. Rather, the right wing in the intelligence community is all over the place, and one should not make too much significance out of something that happens in one's youth. I mention that, though, because a lot of the people associated with John Judge in some way or another do have evidentiary tributaries, and note the phrasing of that, evidentiary tributaries, leading in the direction of many of the things that May Brussel worked and spoke out against. It should also be noted that Kyan, as well as other people at the center, was very afraid at this point. That expressed fear, and my own fears, was one of the reasons that I finally spoke out against the May Brussel Research Center, and again, I will go into that later. It should be noted that Kyan's brother, an attorney, wrote a letter to John on behalf of the Brussel family dismissing him at this point. This is January of 1990, and John's letter of resignation crossed in the mail. As Kyan related, The closing meeting of the center contained the presentation of books, bookkeeping, which at least in the opinion of Kyan and others was not being kept during the course of the May Russell Research Center. And it is within the realm of possibility that more money was actually raised, and that at least in the opinion of Kyan, the books were cooked. It should be noted, too, that when Tom Davis and the aforementioned Will Robinson went to close the account for the May Russell Research Center on behalf of the Russell family, the signature card had been changed. While John Judge was on the East Coast getting his things together, Tom Davis not only co-signed the account for the May Russell Center, but wrote checks against the account so that the center could get going while John was back east. When Tom Davis and Will Robinson, and they have both provided me independently the same account, when they went to close the account on behalf of the Russell family, only John Judge's signature was on the card. It should also be noted that according to Kyan, the bank account for the May Russell Research Center continued to be active for months after the center was already closed. And that is very strange and a little suspicious under the circumstances. Note, too, that when Kyan and some of her friends, including a woman named Karen Gutt, who we will be hearing from later in the broadcast, cleaned the house at which the May Russell Center had been housed in order to get back the security deposit, some $1,480, according to Kyan, John Judge was present, he was around, while the cleaning was going on, assured them that the security deposit would be returned to them. And then John arranged to have the security deposit, a little under $1,500, sent to him as well. Kyan sent a certified letter to John requesting return of the deposit. That certified letter returned unsigned for. As I've said, according to a number of reliable sources, John Judge is now living somewhere in the state of Washington. That may have had something to do with it, but it is strange that the letter was not forwarded. Speaking of forwarded mail, somehow John managed to get the mail forwarded for the May Russell Center forwarded to him months after the formal closing of the center, this despite the fact that he was no longer officially part of the picture. And last, take note of this organization, Prevailing Winds Research, about which I don't know very much, except I do know it grew very quickly and appears to have a fair amount of money behind it. They approached Kyan asking for permission to reprint May's research. I advised Kyan when she called me to ask about this organization and the fellow Patrick Forme, I'm not even sure how his name is spelled, that it just felt like an attempt by John Judge to try and get back in the door, so that I personally advised her against giving permission for them to reprint May's material. As you heard, in the fall of 1990, I heard an appearance by John Judge on radio station KFIAM in Los Angeles. And John, at the end of the broadcast, referred people to Prevailing Winds Research to get more of his work. I also would note that, at least according to one person, and hearsay evidence should be taken with a generous dose of salt, John Judge, or Patrick Forme, had arranged a speaking engagement for John Judge in Toronto. Because that is hearsay evidence, that belongs in the category of interesting, if true, but it is something to bear in mind under the circumstances. That, according to Kyan, is what happened with the May Russell Research Center. Going back to Vankin's book ever so briefly, it's interesting where Vankin writes, in the fall of 1989, Emery burst, restraining himself for a year. He could no longer hold it in and went on the air accusing Judge of financial improprieties and other sordid acts. Well, he did commit financial improprieties, as you've just heard, quite a few of them, at least two of them, in the considered legal opinion of counsel. And again, I'm not an expert in such matters, feloniously criminal. But had Jonathan Vankin been interested in investigating the story, and if he was going to write about it, he should have taken time to do some field work, the financial improprieties could have been very easily confirmed. Now, some of them I myself had no experience with, so I had to talk to Kyan. That's what Jonathan Vankin should have done, and he did not. But beyond that, he could have simply contacted the office of the Secretary of State of California and seen that no papers were ever filed for the May Russell Center over the 16 months of its existence. And frankly, in terms of strict reportage, what Vankin has done here is about as sloppy as anything one could imagine. What you're going to be hearing next is a series of interviews with some of the people who were volunteers at the May Russell Research Center to hear their own accounts of what was going on. Now, once again, we're operating at a distance of some time, and some of what you will be hearing should perhaps be taken with a grain of salt. This is not to cast aspersions on any of the volunteers, but I would counsel that listeners to the broadcast pay most attention and place the most significance on the volunteers' own individual experiences rather than what they heard from someone else. Not that it's irrelevant necessarily, but again, circumstantial evidence, or hearsay evidence, I should say, should be taken with a grain of salt, something, unfortunately, Jonathan Vanken did not do.